From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. To be a brown-skinned immigrant in today's America is to immediately be part of a demographic that has become demonized and weaponized for political use. Octavio Solis, the acclaimed playwright, grew up along the U.S.-Mexico border in El Paso, Texas. In his new memoir, Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, Solis writes poetic vignettes from his childhood and complicates the simplistic narrative that supporters of President Donald Trump have been fed. Octavio Solis has written over 20 plays. He's considered to be one of the most prominent Latino playwrights in America. He's also produced and directed numerous plays and even produced films and won awards and fellowships. He now joins me to discuss his new book. Welcome to the program, Octavio.
Thank you, Sonali. It's my pleasure to be here.
What are retablos for us non-Spanish speaking members of the audience? What does that word mean?
Well, they're a kind of painted thank you note sent to the divine for their way of interceding in a situation that put that individual in some danger, at risk of losing their life, at risk of losing their livelihood, and in some kind of distress. This individual called out for the divine to save them, to help them, and that could be a particular santo or the Virgen de Guadalupe or even God himself. When that help came, this individual in Mexican culture, and some specific Mexican cultures, felt a need to thank the divine for this intercession. And so they ask a painter to paint a representation of that moment of crisis, along with the image of the saint and a little narrative written on the actual picture, thanking the divine for their help in solving this in resolving this crisis. I felt like my stories were like that. I thought of them as a series of retablos, as moments where I felt the divine interceding, and what the divine could be anything. But I felt like these were moments. I had to memorialize these moments that were significant to my growth, to my development as a young man and as an artist in growing up in El Paso.
Can you read a section from your book? There's a section in the early part of your book which I think is very relevant before we get right into your childhood and some of these memories that you write about.
Sure. This is from one of the, it's the second retablo. It's called The Way Over, and it's about how my parents decided to move to El Paso, how they made a change from thinking of themselves as Mexicans and then started thinking of themselves as Americans. And I wrote this. This is a passage from that particular story. I am an anchor baby. Someone coined the term to impugn the motives of immigrants coming to this country. They use it to suggest that for some couples, conceiving a child is not an act of love, but a ploy to secure the rights of residence. But every baby is an anchor baby for young parents navigating the stormy waters of daily life. Every baby is an anchor for those who are looking for their true north, their purpose, their identity. We give our parents hope when they drift from bad times to worse. We give them solace when they consider going back to the little they had before. I anchor them to a place and an ideal worth living for, as they anchor me. We have to go, dice ella. Here is where I live, not there, dice él. But there is where we can all live, you, me, and the child. The child. We have to think of the child.
Octavio Solis has written the new book, Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border, from which he has been reading. So you grew up in El Paso, Texas. This is a border town in Texas. Where were your parents from? You were born here in the U.S., so as you said, you were the, quote, anchor baby. What is the story of your parents? Because, of course, all our stories begin with the stories of our parents.
My father comes from a tiny rural community called Nazas, which is in the state of Durango by the Rio Nazas. And up until he was like 16, he lived and worked with my grandfather and his brothers, tending to the lots they had where they grew alfalfa and corn, barely subsistence living. My mother, on the other hand, comes from an urban center, a large industrial city called Torreon in northern Mexico, in the state of Coahuila. The two of them met there, and they kind of were attracted to each other, but they lost touch until they ran into each other again in the town of Ciudad Juarez, which is just across the Rio Grande from El Paso. And it was there that my father started courting my mom. My grandmother did not want them together. First of all, she thought that my mom was far too young to be courting at the time, to get hooked up with another guy. Mm. So she always scared him off with a broom. She thought he was a hoodlum or something. But when she finally could see that the two of them were deeply in love and intended to get married, she gave them their blessing on the condition that they moved to El Paso and married there, because she said, "I want my children to be Americans." Hmm. And that was a concession they made. My father still tried for a long time to maintain a dual life, living in the U.S. and working in Mexico. He commuted every day across the Rio Grande over the Santa Fe Bridge. But at some point, he got caught and they told him, "Make up your mind. You either live here or you live there." And he said, "Well, my family's there." So the checkpoint guard told him, "Then that's where you live. That's where you have to find a job." So he stayed, and he got his first job. Unfortunately, he'd been selling ads for a radio station in Juarez, fortunately for him. But unfortunately, because he didn't know any English, the best he could do was be a dishwasher in the Greasy Spoon in El Paso.
Hmm. Well, what you were just describing about people commuting back and forth across the border and then, you know, even being asked by authorities to choose is such a completely different situation from what we have today. How common was that back then?
Oh, it was very common. People moved freely across the border to do their shopping. When we were kids, we'd go every weekend to Juarez in the car to tank up the gas tank.
Because it was cheaper.
It was a lot cheaper there to buy gas. And groceries were cheaper. And my mom could buy all kinds of groceries. Not produce, because they didn't allow produce over into El Paso because of the dangers of parasites or insects or whatever. But everything else was game. We always went there at least once a month to get our haircuts. So as children, we used to get our haircuts there. And we also got our prescription drugs there. But we lived and shopped freely in El Paso as well. Hmm. There are people from Mexico who would come and do their shopping in El Paso. Well-to-do families used to come over and go to the mall. My mom, who worked for a long time for a department store in the cosmetics department, had clients who came in would spend up to $300, $400 or so on cosmetics with her. They were important clients, but they came from Mexico. All that started to change when the border became more militarized. They built a border fence in the 80s. That fence, that wall that President Trump is talking about has been there for decades in El Paso. It's there, and it's got cameras on it, and it's got there are guards that patrol it daily all over. And still people find a way over it, under it, around it. they still find a way through.
Despite the fact that when you were growing up in El Paso, people routinely cross the Rio Grande, you also write in your book about the presence of La Migra being, there, ever present. And of course, it wasn't just Mexicans and Mexican Americans living in El Paso. Of course, there were white Americans living there as well, who you write held certain notions and stereotypes about kids like you. So tell us about the other encounters that you had, the non-family encounters you had growing up in El Paso that you write about in your book, Retablos.
We were constantly assailed because we lived, our home was less than half a mile from the Rio Grande. And we lived in the lower valley. And it was one of the areas where there was a lot of crossing. A lot of undocumented people came through there. And therefore, it meant that there were also a lot of cruisers, a lot of Border Patrol cruisers driving around. So it was a cat and mouse game they were constantly playing with each other. And we freely participated in that because they would pull up to us when we were out there playing and they would ask us, hey, did you see somebody walk this way?
So presumably they knew who you were and they knew that you were living there and were born there. They didn't mistake you for a border crosser.
No, I mean, they could tell. They knew who we were. And they would ask us, did you see somebody going this way? And we'd say, well, yeah, we saw somebody going that way. When in fact, we saw the people actually going in the opposite direction. So we would find ways to mislead them, to fool around with them. At night, we'd hide in the bushes and throw water balloons at them. We were just dumb kids. But I had one instance where Border Patrol actually pulled up to me and then started asking me while I'm waiting for the bus to go to the movies, and started asking me questions, trying to verify my citizenship in the country, asking me to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, asking me to point out my address, asking me if I was a citizen. It just made it really, really difficult for me. Mm. They made me feel like I could be taken up and rounded up and put in the corralón, which is the place where they rounded up illegal aliens at that time.
And so you were born in the U.S. What about your parents? Did they have to sort of live in the shadows, or did they obtain their residency and then eventual citizenship?
No, my mom came with my grandmother, and they had legal resident status. My father, though, did not. Hmm. And in the tenement where we were living as children, someone who really disliked my father, also who was Mexican but had legal status too, knocked him out.
Wow.
And they came for him just as he was about to go to work. And my mother says, no, you can't take him. I need him to take care of the kids because I have to go to work. And the gentleman that came to take my dad said, ma'am, don't worry. This is what you need to do. Go to this building, ask for this judge, ask for a stay, and ask him to see what he can do to help grant your husband legal status. So they helped her, and she did just that. And the judge granted him legal resident status until he could get his papers in order. So he was held for a number of days, I think 2 or 3 days, and it was one of the most shameful experiences he'd ever encountered in his life.
Wow.
So for a long time they maintained legal resident status, and we were American citizens, but they eventually, sometime in I think maybe 82, 83, they decided to become full American citizens. Hmm. I think it coincided with Reagan's
amnesty
declaration.
Right.
So now they're full American citizens.
So, Octavio, in addition to encountering Border Patrol, you also encountered, I imagine, and you write about in your book, people who were crossing over the border to come into the United States. Tell us about some of those encounters and what you thought about as a child.
We saw them constantly. They were an everyday occurrence, every night occurrence. Hmm. And we were rather cavalier in our attitudes toward them. But my very first encounter that I remember that was really up close and personal was one time when I was maybe 5 or 6, maybe a little older, but I'd been sleeping. And then I heard this cry, this long keening that woke me up, and it was sounded eerie, sounded ghostly. And I padded very softly in my pajamas into the down the hallway into the kitchen, where I saw my mom and dad were gathered there, and they were tending to two people, a couple, a woman who had been crying very softly that the whole time, and another gentleman in one of those Mexican cowboy hats, and they were soaked to the skin. They had come across in the middle of the night on one of those during one of our freak snow blizzards that we get there on occasion, and they got lost, and they knocked on my parents' doors on the off chance that somebody would help them. Well, my parents immediately brought them in, started warming their feet. I saw my mom. I thought she was making a kind of stew or menudo or something. She had a big olla that she was stirring constantly, but it was rags she was heating up and boiling so that she could get them out and apply them to the woman's feet because they were very, very cold. They were near frostbite. They had waded across the river at a very inopportune time. But my dad eventually helped them and drove them to the destination they needed to go. It felt a little like the Underground Railroad. But I at first I had been so terrified to find these strangers in our home, wondering who they were, wondering what happened to them. They were in distress. They were very tense, and she looked very sick. But then I started getting a little more my attitude shifted dramatically when I saw that she was pregnant. She was going to have a baby.
Wow.
So my dad helped them, led them out to the car, and then drove them to eventually, I think, to where they needed to go. This is, of course, all before cell phones. So all they had was a slip of paper with an address, and it was meaningless to them. Anyway, that was just one instance, but all through my childhood, growing up there, we'd be sitting out at night, having cokes. My dad had a beer, and we would just enjoy it out there. And then we would see a
Right.
group of two or three, sometimes five people, all walking very silently in a northerly direction past our home, and we knew
And
who
what
they
did
were.
your young mind think about all of that? Did you think these are just people like my parents looking for a better life?
It varied. Sometimes I thought that they were like my dad. I didn't know the story about my father until much, much later, until well into adulthood, because my father didn't want to talk about it. My mom was forbidden to tell me about it because he'd been so ashamed of that incident and so ashamed to have been considered, quote unquote, an illegal alien. So I didn't connect them to my parents as much. I just felt like they were a substrata, a class of people who were so disenfranchised that they had no hope in Mexico, and they were coming to a place where all the hope resided. And so they were like moths to the flame. I felt like these people were coming here because this is where the light was. And I never thought of them as criminals. I never thought of them as fugitives. I thought of them as refugees. They were always had a kind of refugee status. And sometimes I just thought that maybe they had families here, and they were just coming to rejoin their families. We had a lady who we called her our maid, and her name was Consuelo, and she took care of us for I think 6 years of our childhood, and she was quite well on in years. She must have been 65, 70 years of age when she started taking care of us, and she was dark Indian skin color, with steel gray hair either in a tight bun or in a long plait down her back, and she came from the mountains of Mexico, deep in deep in Mexico. We didn't even know where. But she had been recommended to us as someone who could do work, or to my parents anyway, and could work at cleaning our house, but especially be there an adult taking care of four children. Because both my parents had to work. And she was like our grandmother. We loved her. She was wonderful. She took care of us. She gently chided us when we were bad, called us when food was ready. She washed our clothes. She tended to our wounds when we scraped our knee or got a bump on the head or something. She cooked special hierbas with the herbs that she had in the backyard, special teas for us to heal us when we were sick, and was a great boon to my mother and father, who were parents that were often away working several jobs. It was really a tough time. But she was also considered, quote unquote, illegal. So she would just come over to, on the pretext that she was going to go shopping in the States, just walk on over, and they would let her over. They'd just look at her pass and go, yeah, okay, come, and then come back the same day.
So completely different from the way the dynamic is at the border today. I want to wrap up our conversation, Octavio, with asking you to bring relevance to what is happening in our current day America. Your experience growing up at the border is so relevant today. And as I said earlier, the way in which immigrants have been demonized and really weaponized for political gain by the Republican Party, and especially by President Donald Trump, that narrative is so simplistic that these are people coming to steal American jobs and what have you, criminals and rapists. And your stories are just the opposite, right?
Oh yeah, we're just people. We're human, and we're prone to the same flaws and the same assets that we bring to the country as anyone else. We're a workforce. We're artists and scientists. We bring craft, real craft and craftsmanship to this country. We're not just landscapers or maids or janitors. There is so much more that we provide this country, and all it takes sometimes is one generation for that impact to be felt on a deep level. The contributions are immense, vast, and deep. And it's a shame that things have come to this pass. You know, I worked on Coco. I worked on the film Coco, for Pixar. I was a cultural consultant for them, and I'm very proud to have worked for that company in helping bring a kind of vision of the immigrant experience to the rest of this country. And I'm impressed at how the nation at large has embraced that film. But the same people who are embracing that film are voting for candidates and voting and supporting a president, supporting policies that are so damaging, I think.
We heard stories after Trump won the election of people who had voted for him and whose undocumented spouse was then being deported, and they thought, well, this isn't what I signed up for. And you just wonder, what else did they expect?
Right. But a lot of it is because, sometimes the mentality of, well, I got on board the ship. It's time for us to bring the ladder up. That kind of mentality infects people's thinking, but it's all motivated by fear that if I don't act this way, I'm going to be targeted. They're going to look at me. As long as I have a MAGA hat as a Latino, then I won't be attacked. I won't be vilified. People will see that I am on their side, that I belong here. Mm-hmm. And so they wrap themselves up in the American flag, thinking that they can then turn to the border and shut it down. And that's unfortunate, because they have to consider how their parents came over, how their grandparents came over, how they still have families in Mexico and in all of Latin America, and in really all around the world that would love to come here. It's sad.
Well, Octavio, I want to thank you so much for this time you've spent with us. Give out a website where people can learn more about your work as well as your new book, which I understand is available in bookstores.
Sure, it's doing very well. The name of the book is Retablo, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. It's published by City Lights Press. You can find it on their website, citylights.com, I believe. My own website is octaviosolis.net. And there you can find all the other plays that I've been working on. I have a new play called Mother Road, which is a kind of sequel to The Grapes of Wrath. Steinbeck is a hero of mine.
Wow.
And it's going to be produced. The world premiere will be at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival here in Ashland, Oregon. I'm very, very proud of it. And I'm very proud to have Bill Rausch, the artistic director, at the helm of this production. I've been working on this for really the last 5 years, and I'm finally I'm gratified to see it finally come to fruition in this way. But this book blindsided me. When I started writing this book, I did not know that it was going to be a book. So I'm very pleased that it even got published, but I'm doubly pleased at the response that I have received across the boards. It's been really satisfying.
Well, I want to wish you again the best of luck. The website is octaviosolis.net, and you can get the book at citylights.com. Thank you so much, Octavio.
Thank you, Sonali. My pleasure.
Octavio Solis has written over 20 plays. He's considered to be one of the most prominent Latino playwrights in America. And we've been discussing his new book, Retablo, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.